Blog Talk Radio.
Of the National Black Teen Empowerment Expo and Unity Design, and it's my distinct pleasure to be your host for tonight's very special Mother's Day broadcast. And as always, the show is produced by the well-known and widely celebrated historian, educator, and author, Leslie Gist Etheridge, and serves as a weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all people, past and present, black and white, who with faith and focus are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. If you'd like to be a part of tonight's conversation, you can call in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552. Again, the number is 347-324-5552. Now, as the first people on this planet, I always enjoy learning about our many firsts. And tonight, we should all be honored to be joined by Marlon Briscoe, the first black NFL quarterback. Welcome to the Gist of Freedom is Faith, Mr. Briscoe, and thank you for taking some time out of this Mother's Day to be with us tonight. And I believe we have Mr. Briscoe on the line with us.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and thank you so much for taking time out of this very, very special day to be our very, very special guest.
Mine.
Let me share with our listening audience a little bit more about you. You are the first black starting quarterback in the NFL as a rookie quarterback with the Denver Broncos. Mr. Briscoe set a record by throwing 14 touchdown passes in 11 games. He also played on the only undefeated team in NFL history and won two Super Bowl rings the years 1973 and 1974 with the Miami Dolphins. A feat that I would suggest has not been repeated since. And so, Mr. Briscoe, why don't you share with our listeners a little bit about some of the quote-unquote misconceptions you've had to overcome as a black quarterback, and especially, I would suspect, as the first black quarterback in the NFL?
Well, you know, historically, before 1968, it was thought that a black man could not think, throw, and lead on an NFL level. Certainly, I should not have been the first black quarterback. There were other quarterbacks, African-American quarterbacks, Sandy Stevens, Wilburn Hollis, Jimmy Ray, to name a few that, you know, certainly merited, you know, an opportunity to play the position. Because they were deemed athletic, as I was, and they used that as an excuse to switch these players to another position. Thought that there would be fan backlash. You know, the majority of the fans that came to the game were white. Mm-hmm. And they thought that if, you know, a black man was behind that position, manned that position, that, you know, fans would, you know, wouldn't come to the game, which was a complete farce. After my first game, we had quite a few more fans in the stands. Another misnomer was that players wouldn't play for a black quarterback. Let's go back to 1968, which was a pivotal year in this country of change, that you know, there were a lot, the majority of my line, offensive line, were white players. 75% of those players were from traditionally southern schools, the Mississippis, the Alabamas, the Tennessees, schools that these players not only never played with a black quarterback, but prior to the 70s in those conferences, never played with black players. They weren't, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a huge learning curve for them as well. So for, you know, them to realize that, hey, this guy can play, you know, irrespective of color, and we're going to play for him. As a matter of fact, these white linemen from the South, their motto was, don't let them touch the magician. Now, there was still...
Well, let's clarify something, too, Mr. Briscoe, because I did a little brief research on you, and a couple of things. You must have been smart because you negotiated your own contract, number one. And in your contract, you put in a clause suggesting that you, who, if I'm not mistaken, you were originally drafted as a cornerback and not a quarterback, correct?
Correct.
And you put a special clause in your contract stating that you wanted to have, if I'm not mistaken, a 3-day tryout as a quarterback as well.
Exactly. I knew from my college coach, the late Al Coniglia, that Denver was one of the only clubs in the NFL that held their preseason practices at the campsite that where, you know, it was available to not only fans but the media as well. And so all I wanted was a forum to showcase what I thought was good enough to get that tryout. Of course, they hesitated vehemently about that, but I was pretty adamant about it. So they acquiesced to, you know, my so-called demands. You know, it gave me a 3-day trial at quarterback, at which time it opens my eyes, so to speak, and start getting some publicity from it. But when I went back to defensive back, I actually was a starter at corner. And I got hurt, Steve Tenzi. Then some things happened that I guess the stars were aligned or whatever. Steve Tenzi got hurt. He was a starting quarterback. Three of the other quarterbacks that were in that 3-day trial, 3-day camp, they got an opportunity. They failed. And so the media and the fans who attended that 3-day trial, well, said, hey, why don't you try the little guy? And I was, you know, I was hurt and on the mend. And so, you know, I got that opportunity and made the best of it. It was not to be the ensuing year, 1969, but I think that if there was to be a quarterback and not just a black quarterback.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, if I'm not mistaken, we didn't even dispel that myth back in the late 60s and when Doug Williams won a Super Bowl ring with the Washington Redskins, there was still a lot of the same rhetoric about a black man being able to think and throw and lead a team to a Super Bowl victory. Do you want to speak to that?
Because well, absolutely. You know,
even in your greatness, we didn't dispel that.
No, and it, you know, look how long it took. You know, first of all, for me to get an opportunity to play the position when all these other quarterbacks should have been able to play. 1969, I was going over a timeline. Four black quarterbacks were drafted as quarterbacks in the NFL the next year, although, you know, I never got a chance to compete at the position again. They used lack of size as a reason. And these four quarterbacks that were drafted, Andre Jackson, James Harris, to name a couple, they were 6'5 or better. And so at least the next year, guys got a chance to play that would not have gotten a chance to play at that position the next year. They would have been tight ends or wide receivers or defensive backs or whatever. But, you know, all the way through the progression of, you know, James Harrison, you got the Joe Gilliams, the Warren Moons, well, the Doug Williams and Warren Moons. You know, Doug Williams, he went to the Super Bowl, and he's out of the league in a couple of years. Well, you know, how's that happen?
Right.
You know, they questioned Cam Newton, and one of the questions about him is his intelligence. Here's a guy who wins the Heisman Trophy. He, you know, goes through an undefeated season. He's done everything that could possibly be done at his position, and they're questioning his intelligence. They're questioning his throwing motion. Well, if they ever saw some of the other quarterbacks in the league that were heralded and their lack of arm strength and lack of, a precise throwing motion, why are they going to bring that up on this kid? And, you know, the McNabbs and the Randall Cunninghams and the Michael Vicks have all come under scrutiny because of their style of play. I came under scrutiny because, my playing style was parallel to Michael Vick's with the running and throwing or whatever, or scrambling and throwing. So they labeled me a runner. Well, how can you run 14 touchdown passes? And then when I've never heard of anybody running 14 touchdown passes. Back in the day, you know, the prototype quarterback they wanted was, you know,
stay in the pocket passer.
Stay in the pocket. But it was, you know, it was funny because they never said anything about the Fran Tarkins who was scrambling. They never said anything about Bobby Douglas, who got 1,000 yards, but he couldn't even pass.
Talk about some of the racial inequities that still persist in the NFL. It's so interesting, and as this is a show that typically celebrates our history, I'd like for you to put a little historic perspective on your playing career. You mentioned that you played right after. I know you also played through the Civil Rights Movement. Can you share with us a little bit more about playing during the rise of our people in this country, during the movement, or as players in the NFL, but more so as a human being and a person?
Well, you know, I graduated from high school in 63, started matriculated to college that same year. So 63 through 68, those are very volatile years in the history of civil rights in this country. Not only civil rights, but just human rights, you know. So, you know, what was going on in this country, whether it was in the South or the North or the Midwest, you know, it didn't matter, you know, West Coast, East Coast, there were huge injustices regarding black people, women, brown people in this country. And so we had to weather the storm of being brutalized, hung, denied, you know, jobs. We ran the gamut, you know, bombs getting, you know, girls getting bombed in churches, hose down, you know, in the South. There's just so many inequities. And, you know, sports just happened to dovetail everything that was happening in this country. Now, the quarterback position, I say this, and people, when I say this, you know, people, they raise their eyebrows at me. But the quarterback position, just like the presidency of the United States was reserved for a white man to
run the country.
And so, when I said that, a lot of people were taken aback, but then they realized, hey, I was just telling what it was. That's just the way it was. If Jackie Robinson hadn't come along, look how long it would have taken another black athlete to play baseball. Look how long it took after Jackie Robinson for a black man to be able to lead on the football field. First of all, there weren't that many blacks playing professional sports. If it had not have been for the rise of the American Football League, a lot of blacks would not have been able, not a lot of Hall of Fame black players would not have been able to make it to that arena because there was a quota system in the old National Football Conference.
And, Mr. Briscoe, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me, Mr. Briscoe? This is Leslie.
Yes, I can, Les.
Thanks for coming on the show, and I apologize for the lateness and everything. But I wanted to ask you, you touched on some very important aspects of black history. And
yes.
Could you just give us, you mentioned Jackie Robinson. You also talked about, could you talk about Cassius Clay?
Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, is one of my all-time favorite, not only athletes, but, he was more than an athlete. Back in those days, particularly black athletes could not voice their opinion on things that didn't pertain to the sport that they were in. And here you have this brash young guy that, he went out and said what was correct. Not politically correct, I guess, but was correct. And, he changed the way, black young athletes thought of themselves, and you take John Carlos and Tommy Smith and those guys that raised the black power sign at the Olympics. Prior to that, we were told, sign your contract, play, and that's it. So athletes like Muhammad Ali, who did something that was probably deemed crazy by America, changed his name and he defied Vietnam. That was something that white America says, black America, we don't, athletes particularly, you can't voice your opinion like that. You got to do
now,
what we tell you to do.
In your career, where were you personally? And I'd like to know what was being said in the black locker rooms. And were they separate locker rooms? I'd like to know, where were you in your career? And when you saw all of these things going on with the other athletes, Cassius Clay and the raising of the fist at the Olympics, what was the talk? We want to be a fly in your locker room. What was the talk amongst the black athletes?
Well, you see, back in those days, black athletes, if you got two of them, just like, you put two or three blacks on the street corner, police are going to arrest them. Too many blacks assembling. So when we were in the locker room, we kind of kept to ourselves. It was after we left practice and we could congregate and talk about things, talk about the pride. Hey, a guy got cut. He was a starting defensive back ahead of me. He got cut because he read Malcolm X between practices and wore an Afro pick. They told him he couldn't wear an Afro pick or read Malcolm. This is at the Broncos. That's how I got the starting job. They cut him because he refused to do it. And so, and his name is Tony King. Tony went on to be in The Godfather and went on to do some good things. And he was the only experienced back we had. But they cut him, because he was reading his history. And he wasn't being militant or anything like that. He just enjoyed reading Malcolm and, he was wearing, he was growing an afro when afro started to be a symbol of surprise for, black males and
right.
women. So, those kinds of things went on.
Briscoe, to continue on this theme, even as a black quarterback, did that grant you any more reverence to being able to speak to some of the social ills that were commonplace and taking place throughout the country during that time?
Well, not really. And see, the thing is, you know, I've been the first black quarterback in every level that I've ever played because the way I grew up in a melting pot in South Omaha, Nebraska. And so, you know, from Pop Warner League all the way through college and into the pros, you know, I always looked at myself as a quarterback, not a black quarterback. So it never occurred to me, I didn't put that much emphasis on the color aspect until Ebony Magazine did a six-page spread on me. And then I realized, well, you know, this is pretty historic for not only black America, but for America, period, you know. And that to be the first, particularly in something like this, when it was so much denied, you know, our people, that option was not a failure. So the one thing that I went in there with, once I realized the importance of the outcome of this deal, was that, you know, I had to win. I mean,
you had to
because if I hadn't have, it would have been a long time before another black would get the opportunity, and then the naysayers and the so-called racists would have said, well, I told you so. So I think, you know, if I have any kind of legacy at all for 1968 is that it paved the way for, you know, other black quarterbacks who wanted to play that position and not be switched. You know, had the litmus test in myself to be able to do that. And I'm not bragging or anything, but, you know, that's just the way it is. And so I'm glad that, you know, I was ordained or however that happens to get the opportunity, you know, to show that, you know, and that it wasn't only about football. It was, other corporate structure, the legal structure, whatever, that given the opportunity, you know, you don't have to be white just to be able to succeed. And so far beyond just football.
Right. And Mr. Briscoe, that seems like quite a weight to burden and bear. You know, in many ways, it seems like you did not only open the doors to other men of color being able to play the quarterback position. It seems like a tremendous burden. And I'd like to ask what role your childhood and upbringing may have had in you being able and capable of reaching that pinnacle of success as an adult.
Well, it had a great deal to do with it. I grew up in a melting pot community, raised around the packing house industry. In fact, four packing houses surrounded the projects in which I grew up. Well, there were so many other ethnic groups, you know, from Europe, from Mexico, from, you know, blacks from the South, you know, whites from Poland and Germany. They all came to Omaha, particularly South Omaha, where the packing houses were located, to work. So, you know, although I lived in the black projects, and there were white projects not even 50 yards away, I still was able to interact with all types of people. And I think that boded well for me growing up and being able to, first of all, play that position and play it from Pop Warner all the way through college with majority white players, and being able to get along and understand and be accepted and accept, you know, people of, you know, other persuasions, you know, other situations. I think that helped me not dwell on the fact that, hey, I was a black playing this position with all these whites on a team. And that I think that helped me even in the pros because, you know, I was going to have to be able to conduct leadership amongst these white players. Now, let's get another thing
on the table.
Yes.
Mr. Brisco, can you hear me? I have a quick question to ask you about something
yes.
Mr. Ali Gordon mentioned earlier about your contract. How did
yes.
that come about that you had to negotiate such a contract so shrewdly and cleverly? I like to.
Well, I want help from my head coach in college. His name is Al Coniglia. He's no longer with us. But he had a short stint as a player with the Green Bay Packers. And, you know, he knew some of the ins and outs and the workings of the professional football, being an ex-player. He was a successful coach, so a lot of the pro scouts would come by to judge and assess, you know, players at my college. And so he had inroads to information about, you know, how camps were held, where were they held, and, you know, he helped me with that information.
How was it normally negotiated?
Well, it's normally negotiated. They tell you, they come in and make you an offer. I was a 14th round draft choice, so certainly they didn't expect me to, you know, as a 14th round draft choice, I wasn't even expected to make the team, let alone make demands that I had made. But you normally, you know, they offer you a contract, you know, you push and pull a little bit, and, you know, they tell you what they want you to do. You either sign it or go home and teach school. And so I was pretty adamant about that, and the fact that, you know, they did not have me penciled in as a quarterback and as a defensive back. I think they knew that athletically I had enough talent to make the team, but they drafted me in the later rounds because nobody would take me because I was a quarterback. And they felt that they could get me as a bonus in later rounds as at a different position. But, you know, it worked out. They didn't, like I said, they didn't want to agree to give me that 3-day trial at quarterback, but I was adamant about it. I wasn't going to sign, but they needed a cornerback. In fact, there were four rookies that started in that defensive backfield when I got to Denver that year. So it was a matter of economics with them.
Would you agree that you had your own little civil rights movement within the Broncos
organization? Well, absolutely. So, the way we grew up in the, you know, the way we grew up in the 60s, all of, you know, things that we had to endure, you know, as African American young kids, you know, we had our share of rejection and back during those times. It was just, you know, it was just a time where, you know, we learned so much about who we were, you know, where we were going, and we wanted to be a part of it. We wanted to stand up and be accounted for at an early age where in the 50s, you know, we were scared to death. That's, we couldn't even walk down the street or walk in another neighborhood.
Would you take more money? Would you have taken more money if they would have offered you more money to take the position that you didn't want to play, other than quarterback? Would you have accepted it?
No, not without the 3-day trial. No, the 3-day trial was, you know, it was a demand that, you know, I wanted. They thought I was crazy because they didn't think that a kid in the 14th round even had a chance to make the team, let alone demand, you know, stipulations in the contract, when they always had the upper hand in the contract. They, you know, you sign what they told you to sign. But, you know, I didn't want to do that, and I didn't do it. And without that 3-day contract, my story would never be told.
Well, that's an excellent story. Now, let's talk a little bit about Jim Brown, then I want to move on, talk about marketing. Who is Jim Brown? Could you explain that to our younger listeners and your relationship with him and how it compares to your history?
Well, Jim Brown, first of all, he's a very good friend of mine, and you know, aside from him beating me up in tennis, I can stand and understand the things that Jim stood for. Jim was his own man, and he was then, and he is now. And being your own man, even before I got to the pros, because he's earlier than I was, he was his own man, and he did things his way. A black man doing things his way in the 60s, that was unheard of. But Jim Brown, you know, he was that kind of guy that it didn't matter what arena he was in, whether he's in, you know, it didn't matter, you know, and he was way ahead of his time. And, you know, young blacks like myself who knew about Jim Brown's story, he was kind of an Ali in football, you know. They paved the way for, because he thought for himself. He didn't let management or money dictate who he's going to be. He would have still been playing football if he hadn't gone over and he was making a movie. And he had another week to shoot. He asked the Cleveland Browns, you know, could he take that next week off of training camp to finish up a movie? Back in those days, you know, you weren't supposed to have anything going on the side other than playing football. They told him no. He told him, okay, I retired. He never played football again.
Wow. Now, is there anybody in football today that you see that emulates the personality and the persona of the 60s of being their own men? Anybody
no.
in today's football?
No, because there's too much. They're making too much money to really address, you know, to address a lot of the issues. You know, we're working right now on for retired players who did emulate the spirit of change for African Americans back in the league, players that played when I was, you know, played right along in the era that I played, who we didn't make that much money. So, you know, we had to struggle to get what we could get, you know. And, you know, players today, you know, they're instant millionaires. They could, you know, a lot of the issues that revolve around, you know, players that have not. A lot of those players, they don't really get that involved. But so
there's not one football player. There's not one football player you would award the Marlon Briscoe Trophy to.
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. In this day and era, no one really sticks out because, you know, they're in a cocoon. They're, you know, under an umbrella because they deal with their own individual issues, which is the fact that they make so much money. You know, they're dealing with, you know, trying to take care of all the immense salaries that they're getting, the offshoot of being able to play the game. You know, we all had to have another job during the off season or go to school. We had to have something else to supplement our income because we weren't making that kind of money. So,
can you talk about the lockout today? What's going on right now with the lockout, the lock-in, the lockout?
Well, you know, I'm certainly, you know, I get emails every day. I'm certainly aware of what's going on. You know, the signing of this new collective bargaining agreement certainly affects me, my pension, you know, my disability situation, just like it does a lot of the other players, particularly retired players. Now, the modern players, you know, the late Gene Upshaw, you know, he got them a sweet deal, but they neglected to take care of the players who made that league, who started that league, who brought the league to the success and the popularity that it has reached. You know, we have been forgotten. And so now, you know, they, you know, with concussions and suicides and, you know, bankruptcies and all that stuff that, you know, have happened to players who gave their blood, sweat, and tears for the league to build the league to a multi-billion-dollar business, you know, we had been forgotten. And, you know, purposely so for a long time. Now it's come to the forefront. We are getting, you know, recognized that, you know, we helped build the NFL and that we deserve more than, you know, what current ownership is dealing us, you know. So we look at...
I have a quick question about that. I watched a segment on 60 Minutes about 6 months ago about the NFL and the Madden football game, video game.
Right.
And they were saying that they're using your likenesses in these Madden
right.
video games. Could you go into depth about that whole scenario?
Well, you know, they found out that, you know, the likenesses, you know, they would, of course, they would change the numbers and, you know, do all the things to disguise who these players were because they didn't have a signed agreement to use their likeness or images, you know, in these video games, wherein, you know, the distributors, they were making millions of dollars, but players were, you know, they were systematically erased from the identification. And so I think it was some kids that really blew the whistle because, you know, they pointed out, well, that, Dad, that looks like you. But it didn't have his number. So there were, you know, there was further investigation. They found out that there were a lot of guys being used, you know, by these companies. I don't think Madden had a, I don't think he had to do anything, you know, with it. But of course, the people that put his product out, you know, they were using a lot of players, and we weren't, you know, we didn't get the licensing agreements, you know, to share in the revenue. And so, you know, there are a lot of things that, you know, a lot of, that the public doesn't know that particularly befalls the retired players. Because we didn't make the kind of money. We, you know, a lot of us can't walk, you know, can't think, you know, I mean, because of concussions, because of the damage of the violence of the game, you know, they overlooked us. So now with it, you know, a lot of this stuff has come to the forefront. We have to give a lot of credit to Brian Gumbel and some you know, some of the other sports casters and who have taken up on themselves to, you know, shed light on the maladies of the retired player. So finally, we, you know, we've gotten a forum, we've gotten some publicity. As to,
give us a wish list. Mr. Briscoe, if you could get exactly what you wanted for the retired players, and what advice would you give to the youngsters? I know you're working with different camps. You know, give us your ultimate goal as a retired player and an advocate for the retirees.
Well, you know, respect. And with respect comes, you know, the financial rewards, you know, the institutional rewards and opportunity. We're never going to recoup all the losses financially that, you know, we did not get rewarded as players, you know. But dignity, you know, there are a lot of guys – they lose their homes, their families, you know, have lost their physicality and emotional and all that stuff. Lost all that stuff, and it was lent on deaf ears by the current NFL establishment. You know, you know,
I didn't have
give the players, you know, give those players, I'm including myself, a measure of dignity, you know, a measure, because, you know, I'm 65. A lot of those guys, are, you know, are in their 80s, dying off or whatever. And before, you know, before that happens, before the life is taken from the breath of these players, who, you know, gave all of their being to the league and had been snubbed by the league for all these years. You know, whatever time we have left, give us a measure of dignity, you know, financially. Make sure that, you know, the injuries that we have that surface when you're after 50 years old, they tell you that you can't apply for disability, and you got these injuries from playing in the National Football, yet they deny your claims. That's crazy. You know, John Mackey, you know, his dementia reform, you know, that helped. But it's still a long way to go, because a lot of players, because of concussions, the lack of good equipment when we were coming up, the lack of good playing surfaces, wherein we received all these debilitating injuries, you know, they turned their back on us when we made these claims. So now they're beginning to realize, hey, we're still alive and we're going to fight for our benefits. And so this collective bargaining agreement has a lot riding, you know, riding for the retired players, probably more than anybody else. Hello?
Can you hear me? What kind of advice do you have for young people who are pursuing a career as a national football player?
Well, you know, certainly, first of all, you know, making it to the professional football in the NFL is likened to hitting the lottery. And aren't that many, I don't care, you know, how good you are, the opportunities you have or whatever, you know, making it, the odds of a kid making it in the NFL is like hitting the lottery. Now, you know, I've been working with the Boys and Girls Club up until my retirement, so I run into a lot of kids. I have a football camp, and I encourage kids to follow their dream. And certainly, if that's what you want to do, pursue it. You know, don't ever let anybody tell you that you can or cannot do certain things. But prepare for an afterlife. Because the odds of you making it are slim. It doesn't matter how big, fast, gifted, you know, there are bumps along the way that could preclude you from making it. By all means, if that's what you want to do, do it. But prepare for the day that it's not going to happen. You know, I fractured my vertebra in my neck playing. I played college basketball for 3 years. I fractured vertebra in my neck. They said I would never play football again. That was would have been my senior year. So, you know, technically, I should have never played football in the first place, professionally. But some, you know, God embraced me. He gave me a healing process on my neck. I got drafted. I got extended another year. I got a hardship case. Went on to make All-American. Got drafted, and the rest was history. But my senior year, it wasn't even football. I got hurt. I got hurt playing basketball. My whole career was over. They said I would never play sports again. I had essentially what was called a broken neck. So at that point, you know, I started my career as an educator. I did some walk-on coaching. You know, I had came to the conclusion that, you know, my sports career was over. But I went to school. I went to college to play to get an education. I used sports as a way to get an education, not to go to the pros.
Can you repeat that?
Huh?
I think that's a very important fact. Could you repeat that line one more time for
you? Yeah, well, you know, I went to college, as did most of the guys and women did when we were coming up. Our parents could not afford to send us to college. So sports was a vehicle and an avenue in which we could get an education. So when we went to college, you know, we went to college to become, you know, professionals in the business world, the education, or whatever. It just so happens at some point in our college career that we were judged good enough to play professionally. But we didn't go to college to play pro sports like a lot of these kids, young kids do today. I run into that all the time. And so, you know, I think that, you know, being said, these kids don't realize that even if you make it, even if you get several million dollar contract, if you didn't go to college, you didn't go to school, how are you going to invest that money? How are you going to keep that money? How are you going to keep it, somebody from taking it from you? See? So, you know, college and getting your education, not just college, all the way, you know, from kindergarten all the way up, you know, through your maturation process, through your building upon an athletic, you know, life, so to speak, you still have to study. You still have to be able to withstand, you know, life's realities. You know, you might make it, but most likely, from that arena, you're not going to make it. But if you have your education, you know, that's going to last you a lifetime, you know. So,
well, on that note, I want to say this was a great interview. I would like to have you to come back on the show and give us updates as far as the football contract and negotiations. Would you agree to do that?
I sure would.
And it's been wonderful, and we're going to have you back on. And thank you for all that you do.
All right. Thank you for having me.
All right. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.